Welcome to the podcast of Media Matters with Bob McChesney, a weekly show on media from WILL Radio. Visit us at will.uiuc.edu.
Greetings. Welcome to Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney, coming to you here on WILL AM 580. Today, we have a terrific show, a recorded program with two talks from the May 2005 Media Consolidation Conference here in Urbana. You're going to hear the speeches of Bernie Sanders, the U.S. representative from Vermont, and Linda Foley, head of the Newspaper Guild, today in Media Matters. But first, let's go to Media Minutes.
Welcome to Media Minutes, a weekly review of news relating to the intersection of media and democracy. I'm John Anderson.
And I'm Kimberly Cronick.
As resistance to the phone and cable companies' drive to turn the internet into their own private informational toll road builds in Congress, the companies are deploying a new tactic in an underhanded attempt to sway opinion on the issue of network neutrality. Several new supposed consumer coalitions have sprung up in recent weeks and months. These groups have impressive names like the Internet Innovation Alliance, FreedomWorks, Hands Off the Internet, and The Future Faster. The common problem with all these groups is that they are not real. They do not represent citizens. They just sound like they do. In reality, groups like the Internet Freedom Coalition are what are known as astroturf groups. That is, they project the image that they represent lots of people on a particular issue, but they're really just front groups for the big telecom companies.
They launch websites, they devise these coalitions, and they try to pretend that there's a lot more citizen activism than there really is. They may gin up letters or faxes to legislators that in some cases are absolutely fake.
That's Dawn Holian. She's the director of media research at Common Cause, a real organization that actually represents citizens and has extensively investigated the use of AstroTurf groups on telecom policy issues like network neutrality. Take the Internet Innovation Alliance, whose website claims to represent, quote, a broad-based coalition committed to more widespread usage and availability of broadband through wise policy decisions. Sounds pretty benign, right?
If you look at their list of coalition members, there are no consumer advocates on that list. But AT&T, a telephone company, is at the top.
Another group, FreedomWorks, boasts, quote, hundreds of thousands of volunteer activists all over the nation.
They've taken grants both from Verizon and SBC, which is now AT&T, and they, too, oppose network neutrality, saying that the telephone companies ought to have the right to prioritize or discriminate against certain types of traffic on the internet so that they can make more money.
The same with the slickly named Hands Off the Internet. It is wholly a creation of AT&T, Bell South, Alcatel, Singular, and the National Association of Manufacturers, just to name a few of its sponsors. And the newest kid on the telecom astroturf block, the Internet Freedom Coalition, sports so-called free market advocates like Americans for Tax Reform as its founding members. You may have heard of Americans for Tax Reform. It was founded by Grover Norquist, the mastermind behind the K Street lobbying project, which has been so successful in turning public policy into a pay-to-play venture over the last dozen years.
This fakery supplements an increasingly strident tone coming from phone and cable companies directly. Link Hoeing, Vice President of Internet Technology Policy for Verizon, hints that unless they get their way on network neutrality, there's not much of a chance that the U.S. will see universal broadband service anytime soon.
We really believe that if we do everything we can to ramp up, get the policies established that help encourage investment and encourage more market deployment by companies, that would be a good way to get broadband across the country.
Although Verizon is on record in support of data discrimination, Hoeing says that doesn't necessarily mean it seeks to extort cash from content providers in exchange for preferential treatment.
There could be a joint marketing venture between the two companies. It could be that you'd have a revenue-sharing model.
Verizon's also not above threatening other sectors of the economy in its drive to stratify the internet. For example, some members of the financial services industry, which spent more than $100 billion last year on computers, network technology, and Internet access, have begun to express concern about how an Internet that plays favorites will affect their business. But in a company memo recently leaked to the press, Verizon's point man on Capitol Hill, Peter Davidson, says unless banks and investment firms play ball, they, quote, better not start moaning in the future about a lack of sophisticated data links they need but won't be able to get. Cable companies also stand to win big if given the ability to engage in data discrimination. At an industry convention earlier this month, Rocco Commisso, CEO of Mediacom, a cable company serving 23 states, told an audience that the government should have no say over how phone and cable companies rent out their networks. Taking a page from AT&T, CEO Ed Whitaker, who infamously remarked that content providers should not be able to use, quote, my pipes for free in the future, Commisso told the convention audience that Internet companies are seeking special favors from Congress in order to make sure, quote, that they can use our pipe and they can make their money and we can't make any. As if cable and phone companies actually gave away broadband access for free.
You've been listening to Media Minutes, a joint production of the Illinois Initiative for Media Policy Research at the University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign and Free Press, a national nonpartisan organization dedicated to media democracy. For more information, visit our website at freepress.net.
Greetings. Welcome back to Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney, here in WILL AM 580. Today we're going to listen to a couple of speeches from the May 2005 conference, Can Freedom of the Press Survive Media Consolidation, that was held on the University of Illinois campus here in Urbana. And the first speech, I think, was from the opening night plenary by U.S. Representative Bernie Sanders. And the second speech is from Linda Foley, head of the Newspaper Guild. With no further ado, I think no introduction necessary, here is the speech by U.S. Representative Bernie Sanders of Vermont. Can freedom of the press survive media consolidation?
I want to congratulate Bob and Ben Scott and the University of Illinois and all of the people who have put on this conference and have said that media consolidation and what's happening with regard to corporate control over the media is a huge issue. If you are concerned about the environment, if you're concerned about women's rights, health care, foreign policy, Iraq, the economy, if you are concerned about any of those issues, you must be concerned about the media. And what people like Bob and John Nichols and others have been saying for years, which I fully agree with, is we have got to make corporate control over the media a political issue in the same way that health care and education and Iraq is a political issue. And that means that when somebody runs for office and comes before you and they talk about the issues, you raise your hand and say, what are you going to do about corporate control over the media? And after the candidate recovers, after his fall on the ground, he or she will start responding. But we have got to make it a political issue because it is as important or more important than any other issue that we talk about. Let me begin by telling you how I first recognized that media was a huge issue. Way back in the 1970s, before I became mayor of Burlington, Vermont, I did a little bit of independent writing. And I did a video, if you like, not quite a film, on the life of Eugene Victor Debs, who some of you know was one of the great labor and socialist heroes in America. And I did it because nobody in Vermont, none of the kids and kids in America today do not know who Debs was, as they do not know the names of many great American heroes. Well, we did the video, and it was not very sophisticated, but it was a fairly good video done for a few thousand dollars. And we took it to our local public television station. And we said, here's a video, and we'd like you to run it. And they looked at it, and 1 month went by, and 2 months went by, and 3 months went by, and then they finally wrote back, and they said, sorry, Mr. Sanders, we can't use your video because it doesn't tell both sides of the story. Because as you know, on all programming that you see on public television, you always hear the socialist and capitalist point of view, the progressive and conservative. That's the way it is. But so they couldn't put it on. Well, that got me a little bit upset. And it turned out that in Vermont, there were other people who were not necessarily political, but they were local filmmakers, Vermont filmmakers, and they were unable to get their films on Vermont public television. The result of that is we started a little bit of a movement, and we put pressure on our local public television station. And the outcome of it was one of the great nights of my life that I will never forget. The University of Vermont, which owned the public television station, agreed to negotiate with us, and we worked out a town meeting of the air on prime time, 3 hours, prime time Vermont public television, to discuss what should public television in Vermont be. So we had about 15 people from the establishment who thought the status quo was good, and we brought 15 people who wanted change. And the guy who was moderating it opened up the phone lines. And this is the truth. So many phone calls came in that the phone line to that station in Winooski, Vermont, actually broke down. So I got the clue that media was an important issue. And as Bob mentioned, I think our office held the very first town meeting on corporate control over the media a number of years ago. Jeff Cohn, who's one of the founders of FAIR, came to Vermont. And Bob McChesney and John Nichols have been up. We held a meeting with Michael Copps, who on media consolidation has been doing an outstanding job as a member of the FCC. We had 600 people coming out to St. Michael's College to discuss that issue. So anyone who tells you that media is not an important issue is missing the boat completely. It is enormously important, and the people of America want serious discussion and resolution on the issue. Now let me tell you why. The perspective that I can bring in with a very distinguished panel is that of a politician, an elected official, who tries to use his office to educate and organize, as well as to pass legislation and do the things the members of Congress do. And let me tell you some of the concerns that I have with what's going on in the media today. Am I concerned that when I am asked to speak about an issue like Iraq, I get 6 seconds to respond? Yep, I'm concerned. Because I can't, and you can't, and our panelists can't, and nobody can discuss an issue intelligently in a 6-second soundbite, which is what dominates television, which is the most important medium in our country. Am I concerned that by definition, corporately owned media is pro-corporate? Yeah, I am very concerned about that. We see the manifestations of that all over the place. We saw the difference between how the corporate media treated a moderate Democrat like Bill Clinton as opposed to a conservative Republican like George Bush. We saw how they covered the lead-up and the war in Iraq so that millions of Americans, in order to get unbiased news, had to go to the CBC in Canada or the BBC. Am I concerned about that? I sure am. Am I concerned that the media seems to think that one of the major issues facing civilization today is the Michael Jackson case? Or maybe, break it to you, Britney Spears is pregnant, it's true, and we'll have many months of discussion about that, or the local trials, or the horrible crimes. Am I concerned about that? I sure am. But of all of those concerns and many more, let me tell you what my deeper concern is. My concern is not just what the media reports or discusses and the slants that it has on the issues. That's important. But the deeper concern is what the media does not talk about. And as an elected official, as a public official, this is of huge concern to me, and I will tell you why. If media does not reflect the reality of people's lives, does not talk to people in a way that they say, yeah, that's me, that's my experience. If media ignores the reality of people's lives, then people end up thinking, gee, I'm making $8 an hour, I can't afford to take care of my family, I must be the only person in America in that position. It's my fault. And I don't have any health insurance. I guess I must be lazy or irresponsible. It must be my fault. It's not a political issue. It's not a social issue. It's not a solvable issue. It's just my issue. So let me just talk about some of the issues that the media does not talk about. To my mind, the most significant non-discussed issue in American society is the collapse of the middle class. In the last 30 years, as everybody in this room knows, there has been an explosion in technology and worker productivity. That means that every one of you is today or will be in the future far more productive than people who held your job or a similar job 30 years ago. One might think that with that explosion of technology and worker productivity, that the average American would either be making more money by working the same number of hours, or in fact, making the same amount of money and working fewer hours. That's what one might think. The reality, of course, is that despite this huge increase in worker productivity, the middle class is shrinking, people are working longer hours for lower wages, poverty is increasing, and the standard of living of millions of people is in decline. When I was a kid, the expectation was that one breadwinner in a family, in those days usually the male, one could work 40 hours a week and earn enough money to pay the bills. Today, you don't know any family, any middle-class family who's in that position. Husbands and wives, people are working incredible hours. In my state, it is not uncommon for people to work not one job, but two jobs, but three jobs to make enough income to get health care, to get the benefits that they need. That is the story of our time, and that is the story that the media does not talk about. What else? Now, one of the reasons that the middle class is shrinking is that we are seeing an unprecedented gap between the rich and the poor in America today. Richest 1% owns more wealth than the bottom 90%. CEOs of large corporations earn more than 500 times what their workers make. Wealthiest 17,000 families earn more income than the bottom 20 million American families. You have an economic issue, is that wealth is being created, but it's going to the people on top. Now, you tell me how often you hear that issue on television or radio. That's about right. That's close to exactly right. It is a non-discussed issue. So in a world where we talk about family values and morality, forget economics here, how often are we posing the question of the appropriateness of seeing in this country a huge increase in billionaires while at the same time we have the highest rate of childhood poverty, 20%, in the industrialized world? Who is posing that moral question? Haven't heard Pat Robertson speaking about it lately. Everybody knows, even my colleagues in Congress, that our health care system is disintegrating. We all know that 35 million Americans have no health insurance, more are underinsured. We pay the highest prices in the world for prescription drugs. And yet, most Americans do not know that the United States of America is the only nation in the industrialized world that does not guarantee health care to all people as a right of citizenship. Have you seen the programming on television talking about that simple fact? Very often in Vermont, I go out and I talk to kids a lot. I love doing that. I go to almost every high school in the state. And I say to kids, tell me, how much does it cost? You know, kids are all struggling to figure out how they're going to afford to go to college. How much does it cost to go to college in Germany? And some kids say, I think it's free in Germany, which it is. How many Americans understand that higher education in Europe, and Scandinavia, and even Canada is substantially lower, in some cases free? And why is that? And what does that have to do with Europe? You know, Europe has its share of serious problems. When you get pregnant in the United States, we fought very hard, and we are going to get you a 3-month family leave. Wow. You can't get fired when you get pregnant. Isn't that something? How many Americans know that in European countries you get 6 months of 8 months with guaranteed payment, with 50-75% of your paycheck coming in? So in this country, after you have a baby, yeah, you can't get fired by staying home, but if you don't have any money, you have to go to work anyhow. How many people know that? Do we talk about that? The United States today has a $618 billion trade deficit. Our entire trade policy is a gross failure. We have lost millions of decent-paying jobs, and we're about to hemorrhage millions of good-paying information technology jobs. What about? I had fun recently. Last month, I had the opportunity to testify before the Ways and Means Committee on trade. And when you ask people about the propriety of having American workers forced to compete against people who make 30 cents an hour and go to jail, as they do in China when they try to form a union, you know what? Nobody has a response. And yet every editorial page of every major newspaper in America has supported NAFTA and free trade with China. How often do we hear that discussion in the news? The president, whenever you see the president, he is always or very often in front of the military people. The background is the troops behind them, giving a speech telling us how much he loves the troops. How often have you seen in the newspapers the fact that this president's budget has slashed, decimated health care for veterans in this country? Slashed it. So when people ask themselves, they say, why is it that working class people vote against their own economic interest, which many do? One of the reasons is that the economic reality facing the working class of this country is very rarely discussed. In fact, even the concept of working class, working people as a class, is not acknowledged. Question. Here it is. You ready? You're all very bright people here at the University of Illinois. Name me three leaders of the American working class. What is this guy talking about? What does that mean? There's nobody. What? What does that mean? You don't know anybody. There is nobody. You got tens of millions of people who are in the working class. You define it however you want to. People who are struggling to keep their heads above water. Who are the leaders? We don't know who the leaders are. We don't recognize working people as a class. So how do we go forward if we can't even define that? How many of you have seen on television, we have many, many, millions of workers, not enough, numbers are going down, in trade unions. You tell me, and I want you to be honest, how many of you have ever seen a program on television discussing the role and the positive role that trade unionism has played in America in improving the lives of the American people? Anybody seen a program? Okay. So, to my mind, when I get concerned, my concerns about the media are everything that I've told you, but it's essentially that there are every morning a few people at CBS and NBC and the New York Times and so forth who decide this is the news today. But that news, time and time again, ignores the real reality facing the people of America. Just last night, I held a town meeting in a small town called Springfield, Vermont. And we are 250 people out to talk about poverty. And they were not intellectuals. They were not academics. They were poor people. And they wanted to talk about the experiences of their lives, living without health care, working at Walmarts, and so forth and so on. Think about what would be happening in this country politically if we had serious discussion on those issues, if people knew that they were not alone, if people learned about how change could take place when people work together. So when you talk about media, probably the most significant thing is that corporate media deflects attention away from the reality facing the vast majority of our people. And our job is to bring reality home so we can take a cold, hard look at what goes on and then figure out how we can improve the situation. But if we don't see that reality, we're never going to be able, in my view, to improve it. Just let me carry that argument just for a few more minutes into foreign policy. Our president, as you know, is a great believer in freedom. He wants to bring freedom all over the world. In the 1980s, some of you may remember that President Reagan spent God knows how many hundreds of millions of dollars bringing freedom to the people of Nicaragua. And if many of you were adults at that time and you were reading the newspapers, you knew that almost every single day, Nicaragua, a tiny, tiny country in Central America, every day it was on the front pages of the newspapers. If a Sandinista policeman pushed somebody, it was literally a front page story. Well, the Sandinistas lost. The Contras came to power. You go to your computer and you check out how many stories have been written about Nicaragua in the last 10 or 15 years as they celebrate and enjoy the freedom that the Reagan administration brought to them. And you're not going to find very much written at all. It's a non-story now. But what you might find, if you look hard enough, is that unemployment in Nicaragua, the last time I looked, was about 50%. 50, that's a 50. Last time I looked, that was a year ago, there were some instances of starvation in Nicaragua. Last time I looked under their free society, and this is a very poor country, a crooked president managed to steal over $100 million, which is quite a feat from a country that has no money at all. Did you ever hear much discussion? Did it make the front page of the New York Times? I don't think so. And that's an important lesson when we talk about, quote-unquote, freedom in Iraq as well. One of the issues, obviously, that we are dealing with in Congress right now is the issue of media consolidation. All of you know or should know that several years ago, Bush's chairman of the FCC, Colin Powell's son, Michael Powell, led an effort toward what they called media deregulation. And what that meant essentially is that at a very dangerous moment in our history, when as a result of mergers and consolidations, fewer and fewer large corporations control what we see, hear, and read, the numbers getting smaller and smaller, these guys said, that's not good enough. We have to make it even fewer. And never forget that in the waning days of the Soviet Union, you know, people thought, well, there was one newspaper and one television station. There were not. There were many, many newspapers, many radio stations, many television stations. The only problem was is that they were all controlled either by the Communist Party of the Soviet Union or by the government of the Soviet Union. What do you think is happening in America today? You're looking at a handful of large media conglomerates, Disney, Viacom, News Corp, General Electric, Time Warner, and a few others controlling almost everything that you see, hear, and read. It is not just television. It is radio. It's not just radio. It is book publishing. It is magazines. It is the movie houses. And you're seeing fewer and fewer control that. So the Bush administration looked at this problem and said, we want even fewer corporations to control it. So they put through some rules which were a disaster, which would have allowed fewer companies to control what we see, hear, and read. Among many other things, what their regulations would have done is done away with rules regarding cross-ownership. What this means is in a town like this, Champaign-Urbana, you could end up, if Bush gets his way, with one media corporation owning your local daily newspaper, a television station, radio stations, and your cable outlet. One station. One company owning all of that. The good news is, to the FCC and Michael Powell's surprise, people rose up against those regulations. And millions of emails came into the FCC, 99% of which said, do not allow for more media consolidation. And then members of Congress began to raise the issue. And we had an interesting coalition coming together, not just progressives like myself, but a lot of conservatives came together on that issue. The end result is that by a 2-1 decision, an appeals court in Pennsylvania threw out what the Bush administration did, and we're back to the drawing boards. So we have some time. But on this issue of media consolidation, I would hope that all of you will stand up and fight. Fight for localism. Fight for a radio and television station locally owned, which will deal with what your school board, what your city council, what the people in this community deal with. Fight for diversity, for people of color to be able to own radio and television stations. Fight to make sure that when you turn on radio or television, you're not just going to hear the Rush Limbaughs and the Sean Hannitys of the world, but you're going to hear the Amy Goodmans and other points of view as well. There is another issue that is going on right now that is also of huge concern, which not a lot of people know about, but it is terribly important, and you should know about it, and you should be actively involved on this issue. A couple of months ago, by a very strong vote against my vote, the House of Representatives voted to raise the fines for quote-unquote indecency. And what this means is that if somebody is on the Amy Goodman show and starts throwing out four-letter words, somebody could call up and say, I was absolutely offended by that. And if people wanted, they could fine the guest or her, if this bill goes through, $500,000. And I doubt that you could sustain that. All right? In my state now, the fellow who is head of Vermont Public Television wrote to me, and he said, as a result of what they are doing, we are now looking, taking a very hard look at the programming that we do. We do independent films. We're going to look very hard about what we're going to put on the air. How many of you saw a very good film called Saving Private Ryan? Anybody see it? It was, in my view, a very good film. It won 5 Academy Awards, starred Tom Hanks. ABC, last November, in honor of Veterans Day, decided to air that film across the country. Unbelievably, over 60 ABC affiliates on Veterans Day refused to show a film depicting the incredible sacrifice and heroism of those men who fought and died on D-Day and for the liberation of Europe. Didn't show the film. Do you know why they didn't show the film? These are ABC affiliates, not little rinky-dink radio stations. The affiliates were afraid that in the course of the show, the course of the film, profanity was used by soldiers. And they were afraid that if they showed that film depicting in an incredible way the real-life struggles of men under attack, that they would be fined. So if ABC affiliates, ABC, one of the major corporations in our country, is afraid to show an Academy Award-winning film, believe me, there is a chill. There is a movement towards censorship in America. But obviously, it's not only Saving Private Ryan. The Chancellor, a moment ago, mentioned that there was a PBS program whose goal is to show how different people make different products and how we're all one country and we all do different things. Well, they came to my state. They came to Vermont. And it turns out that there was a gay couple who were making maple syrup. And I urge you to buy Vermont maple syrup. It is very good. The new Secretary of Education contacted the PBS and said, we do not want you to send this program out over the airwaves. So they didn't, and people could show it independently, but they didn't send it out nationally. Some of you may remember that MoveOn.org wanted to run an ad, pay for an ad, pay a pretty price, I should tell you, for an ad on the Super Bowl, which criticized President Bush for running up the highest deficit in our history. And CBS said, sorry, we're not going to put that ad on the air. The United Church of Christ developed an ad which essentially said that we as a church welcome gay people into our church. CBS and NBC said, nope, that's too controversial. We can't put that on the air. Sinclair Broadcasting, which owns a number of affiliates, decided not to put a Ted Koppel show on the air, which in a sense was a memorial for men and women who had died in the war in Iraq. It was too anti-war, according to those people. Now, if these guys get away with what they want, which is to raise the indecency fine from $32,000 to $500,000, trust me, that people are going to be looking over their shoulders all over this country in terms of what's on the air. Now, that is very bad. Let me tell you what is potentially much worse. And that is we have some people, like Senator Stevens of Alaska, who has said, yes, of course we have to crack down on programming on over-the-air television, which the FCC has regulated for many years. But that's not enough. We now have got to go to cable, we have got to go to satellites, we have got to go to the internet. That's Senator Stevens. Now, what does this mean? What it means in practical terms is that programs like Bill Maher's program, Jon Stewart's program, The Sopranos, Sex and the City, maybe even Friends, because they are a very suggestive group of young people. A lot of sexual innuendo there. They're going to be off the air. They're going to be off the air or pushed very late into the night or radically changed. And for the first time, the FCC is going to venture into cable in an area which many of us, including, interestingly enough, Michael Powell, believes is unconstitutional. Bob McChesney can tell you the difference about regulating over the air as opposed to cable. But the FCC has not gone into cable. It's not over the air. You're paying for it, and they're now saying we can go into your homes, even though you're paying $50 a month or more to get this programming, and because fundamentalists do not like that program, you can't watch that. And then the president tells us about freedom in Iraq.
Hi, I'm Bob McChesney on Media Matters. You're listening to a speech by U.S. Representative Bernie Sanders, Can Freedom of the Press Survive Media Consolidation? Here on Media Matters today. This speech was first given in May 2005 in Urbana, and we're carrying it here on the program for you to enjoy today. So please stay tuned, and thank you for listening.
So what do we do? And let me conclude in this way. Number one, for any serious progressive, the issue of media consolidation, the issue of censorship, the fight to create a media where different points of view can be heard, the fight to break down the situation where so few control so much in media, should be one of the most important issues, if not the most important issue, that you deal with. And interestingly enough, on that issue, you're going to find a lot of support out there from people with very different political persuasions. Very few people think that it is the American way to have a few corporations controlling what we learn about and what we see and what we hear. I hope that you will be involved in the issue of media consolidation. We can win this struggle. I can tell you, because I talked to Michael Powell about it, he was stunned by the grassroots opposition to what he and his friends were trying to do. And people like Bob McChesney and others and you really woke them up. They thought that people would be asleep at the switch. Who cares about some abstract? Who knows what the FCC is? Who cares about FCC rulemaking? That's what they were hoping. But they were hit with a big surprise. And in terms of this censorship issue, reach out to everybody you know. People do not have to be progressive. People do not even have to be political to know that it ain't right for commissars in Washington, D.C. to tell them whether or not they could watch The Sopranos. So I think that this is an issue that can generate a lot of public support. I think that the Bush administration has completely overreached on that issue, and I think we can win it. So, as a result of the work that many of you have done, issues of media have now risen substantially in terms of public discourse in America. This issue is so significant that even the media occasionally mentions it. So we're making progress. And I know Bob McChesney tells me that every time he holds a forum, more and more people come than they anticipate. So it is a huge issue. If we believe in a vibrant democracy, it's an issue that we must be concerned about. It's an issue that we can win. And when we open up media in America and we allow the people to hear different points of view, we can begin to change America in all the ways that it must be changed. Thank you very much.
That was Bernie Sanders, the U.S. representative from Vermont, speaking on Can Freedom of the Press Survive Media Consolidation? Here, it was a tape of a speech he gave here in Urbana, Illinois, in May 2005. I'm your host, Bob McChesney, here on Media Matters. For the balance of the show, we're going to listen to the speech by Linda Foley, the head of the Newspaper Guild, addressing the exact same subject that was given the following day here on the University of Illinois campus. So with no further ado, here's Linda Foley.
Thank you. Orville sort of was a very good discussion prior to what I want to talk about today, which is the effect of consolidation both on journalism and on journalists, particularly journalists in the mainstream media themselves as individuals. But before I do that, last night we heard from Congressman Sanders and Amy Goodman and Naomi Klein about stories that are not being covered. And I also want to mention, and I would be remiss if I didn't mention, that there is a huge story in this country that isn't being covered, among other huge stories that aren't being covered. And that's the dissolution and dismantling of the free trade union movement in this country. You never see this in the press. You do see inner scene squabbles between unions covered occasionally, but you don't see the fact that actually, the ability to organize and belong to a free trade union in this country is imperiled and is just about on the verge of being wiped out. And I would just say to you that along with a free press, freedom of association is also part of the First Amendment, and there never has been a democracy in the history of the world that has not had a free trade union movement attached to it. So I just put that on your radar as well. In terms of consolidation of the media and corporatization of the media, I think that in terms of journalism and its effect on journalism, we need to understand what journalism is and how corporatization and consolidation of the ownership of the media affects that. And there's a quote that I really like that describes journalism that I operate from this presumption, and that is, this was said by Lord Norcliffe, and he said, "Journalism is a profession whose business is to explain to others what it personally does not understand." And in a complex world, the complex world that we live in, that's a very, very important role that journalism plays. Journalists themselves need to be connected to their communities. They need to be connected to the people that they are serving. And what is happening because of the increasing absentee nature of the ownership of media outlets, particularly local media outlets, there is a wall being erected between the journalists in the newsroom and everyone else, except a very small class of people who hold Wall Street values, as has been said. Why is consolidation happening? Well, if you look at consolidation of ownership and you look at consolidation of the media, for one reason, the media is being consolidated to gain efficiencies, and that means more profits, and that's really the reason that it's happening. It's pretty simple. What that has meant for the journalists in the newsrooms is, right off the top, it has meant job cuts. There are fewer newsroom jobs, 1,200 fewer newsroom jobs, to be exact, than there were a decade ago in the industry I'm most familiar with, which is the newspaper industry. But total employment in the newspaper industry has increased during that same period. At the same time, actually, the number of people who consider themselves journalists or who would like to consider themselves journalists has grown. But there are other cuts as well. This strive or this race toward efficiencies has caused other cuts to save costs in the newsroom. Investigative reporting has suffered. Investigative reporting is something that takes a tremendous amount of investment, and that investment is not being made because it's not cost effective. Localism has suffered. You know, in journalism, and particularly in the area of journalism that I'm most familiar with, which is print journalism, daily newspapers, it's all about location, location, location. You have to be in the locale. You have to know what's happening in the community. You have to be connected to that community. And as a result of all these trends, it's created kind of a bubble around reporters in the mainstream media. There is a real elitism that has grown up around the whole newsroom culture of today. I think that readers, audiences sense that, and I think that that also explains a lot of the turnoff and distrust in the media. The reporters that I represent, oftentimes their stories don't represent what's happening to real people, and I think real people know that. Their employers' reaction to that, the reporters' employers' reaction to that, has been, among other things, to restrict further interaction between those mainstream reporters in their community by erecting more barriers. For example, saying that reporters can't be involved in their communities and trying to impose codes of conduct that actually are portrayed as ethics codes, but they're more about conflicts of interest, which need to be monitored. Reporters need to be mindful of not writing self-serving stories. But I think that we've gone overboard to the point where reporters are actually isolated from real people. So there are fewer reporters, fewer resources devoted to news gathering. And then what that's resulted in on a very personal level for those reporters is there's less passion about journalism for those who are left. You know, this used to be fun. It used to be a fun profession to be in. It's not so anymore in the mainstream media. That, too, adds to the loss of credibility with the public who, you know, senses that. I mean, you know, if there's less passion for covering the news, then the news is going to be covered in a more superficial way. I think there are several trends that we need to try and reverse, and these are tall orders because I don't know that you can reverse these trends, but there are several, I'll say, trends that we need to fight. One is the commoditization of news. This is in addition to the overall media reform movement that has, as was described last night, been fairly effective recently at turning back the move to further deregulate media ownership. But in addition to that, I think that we need to fight other things that are happening. One is the commoditization of news. For most of these conglomerates, news in particular, is a very minor part of their business. I mean, even the pure media companies, like, for example, Tribune Company or Gannett or any number of other media companies that we think of in terms of, you know, these folks are in the news business. News itself is becoming a smaller and smaller portion of the business that they are in. And then when you look at a lot of the other big players like ABC, Disney, and GE, NBC, Universal, or Viacom, not only news but media is a very, very small piece of an even larger conglomerate. Conglomerate and amalgamated business plan that they have, and that makes it increasingly difficult to get an investment in news. So some of the stuff that Orwell was talking about in terms of the ownership and how news and information is a part of business and how it's funded, how it's run as a business is really, really important to this whole struggle. Just as an illustration, we did a survey last year among our members, along with AFTRA, the American Federation of Television and Radio Artists, the Writers Guild of America East, and the National Association of Broadcast Employees and Technicians, unions that all represent journalists. And we did a survey among our members and asked them, what do you think is the biggest problem with newsrooms today in terms of, you know, working in the newsrooms and getting your work done? And they said that it was the corporate influence, that ahead of anything else, ahead of job cuts and everything else, was really what hindered them the most in doing their jobs. Another, I think, thing that needs to be worked on here is the wall between news. We need to tear down the wall between news professionals and their communities. News organizations need to hire fewer business reporters and more labor reporters or workplace reporters. They need to hire fewer financial reporters and more farm reporters or rural reporters, rural community reporters. They need to connect back to the communities that they cover. And journalists need a voice at work. That's why I'm with the Newspaper Guild. I started off as a journalist, not as a trade unionist. And I came to the Newspaper Guild because I feel very strongly that journalists need a voice at work. They need to be able to fight for stories. And they need to be able to push to get things covered without the fear of being retaliated against by their corporate bosses. News organizations also need to infuse diversity in their operations. That means diversity of all kinds, diversity of viewpoint, diversity of coverage, as in communities that we cover, and diversity in ownership of outlets. And, you know, you could get into a whole discussion about bloggers and how the whole blogosphere has risen as a news source. And I think that has to do with diversity and the fact that mainstream news organizations do not provide enough diversity of viewpoint and of coverage of different voices in what they do. And then finally, news organizations need to make restoration of credibility the top priority, not just in the newsrooms, but in the boardrooms. That means that a code of ethics in the newsroom to prevent plagiarism is a good thing. But there also needs to be a code of ethics for the boardroom. There needs to be a code of ethics in the circulation department. There needs to be a code of ethics in the advertising department. These industries have to be clean, they have to be credible, and they have to speak to what people think are good values. And then finally, this notion, and we heard a little bit about this last night, of targeting journalists, both physically in places like Iraq, where a record number of journalists have been killed, 63, I think, was the last count, or even in this country where there's always, no matter what the story is, if the story is about George W. Bush not serving in the National Guard or missing out on his Guard service during Vietnam, and then it turns around, they blame the media, and all of a sudden blaming the media and blaming Dan Rather and finding and looking for mistakes that Dan Rather made becomes the story. So the journalist, instead of George W. Bush's service, becomes the target. There is a blame the media, meaning blame the reporters, feeling in this country that we need to change. You can't keep targeting reporters and news people and expect them to do their jobs in a way that that is conducive to public discourse. And then finally, I'd just like to put in a plug for an effort that we're undertaking in the Guild, in that we are going to come up with, or we're in the process of developing, our own code of ethics for this industry, one that, yes, deals somewhat with conflict of interest, but really is set, we want to set out a way to promote credibility, to restore credibility back in this industry, to really talk about ethical practices that need to be imbued in this industry. And hopefully, if we can do that from the bottom up, we'll get some buy-in from the top down. No guarantees on that, but I think there needs to be pressure on those folks at the top to really really be as ethical as they're supposed to be in running a business as important as this. And then finally, I just wanted to end with a quote from James Madison, because I think oftentimes, particularly in the media reform movement, of which I consider myself very much a part of, we sometimes get kind of depressed and we get very negative about the press. But I always go back to this quote from James Madison because I think it's important to keep this in mind. And he said, "To the press alone, checkered as it is with abuses, the world is indebted for all the triumphs which have been gained by reason and humanity over error and repression." And I think our goal has to be to make sure that when it comes to the media, that humanity triumphs over repression. Thank you.
A speech by Linda Foley, who heads the Newspaper Guild, delivered at the forum, "Can Freedom of the Press Survive Media Consolidation?" held last month on the University of Illinois campus in Urbana. Before that, the comments of Vermont Representative Bernie Sanders, who also addressed the conference. And for this week, that's Media Matters. For more information on Media Matters or to hear past programs, visit the website wyll.uiuc.edu. And follow the links.